Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, our guest is Sam Matheny. He's the Chief Technology Officer and the EVP at the National Association of Broadcasters. This guy knows technology and keeps looking toward the future to help broadcasters. We'll hear from Sam, plus Chris Tobin joins us on this week's Twirt.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by the Calrec Type R console system. Type R is a brand new, modular, expandable IP-based radio system from Calrec Audio.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and I'm delighted to be here from... let's call it the Eastern Command Center of This Week in Radio Tech. I'm in the Great Smoky Mountains on the side of a mountain here and just have a beautiful view of the, well, clouds and rain today. We're not in our usual Telos Alliance studio. We'll be back there next week in the Telos Alliance studio. But today we're in actually a place called Blessings Cabin. And it really feels good to be here on the second day of the year. So we're about to talk about broadcasting and the future. And let me bring in my partner in crime, our co-host for the show. Chris Tobin is here from WBGO. Chris, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech.
Thanks, Kirk, and Happy New Year to everyone. This is a good time. And I'm here in the small booth, and what's behind me is just one of the banners. We were just doing some recordings here in the booth, and if you want to check out the program, it's called The Checkout. It's the up-and-coming discovery of jazz artists, young and new and old, and you go to our website, you'll find out more. So I've been getting emails from folks asking about some new discovery music, so I thought I'd put this in the back of the camera for today.
You know, discovering music, I was kind of a child of the 80s with the music from the 80s and the 90s, a little bit of the late 70s. And it's great to discover new music that you can identify with, because it seems as though I hear a lot of music I don't identify with. Do you feel that way, Chris?
Well, from time to time, sure. I mean, I listen to all kinds of music, so sometimes I find some of the wackiest stuff. But yeah, but it's interesting, some of the discovery we've been doing with a lot of folks. We did some stuff in South Africa, and you talk to the musicians who come over to do some of the local clubs here in New York City, and you ask them their influences, and it's the funniest—not funny, but it's fascinating—the diversity of, well, let's see, there's Fats Domino, Elvis Presley, the Beatles, and here's a guy who's a world-renowned pianist, and you're like, wow, okay, this is cool, and it's fun. I'm glad to hear these things, but it's just telling folks some of the stuff that I get to talk to musicians about, and it's just, everyone has this. I guess it's because everyone has this thought process. Well, if you play classical, then you must only think this way. Or if you play pop, you must only think this way.
Oh,
and, you talk to a jazz musician who's well known for his piano, trumpet, or sax, or any instrument, and you find out that the person's favorite is Jethro Tull. And we did have somebody in who tell us that during the interview. So, you're sitting there going, wow, but you just played that piece from Take the A-Train and Duke Ellington, and you played it so well, but your influence was Jethro Tull. Hey, you're sitting there going, Iron Man? What do I do? Aqualung? It's like, wow, how do you go from a interview from that? So I just think it's great. And it's true in technology, too. There's a lot of times I talk to folks who are technologists and say, hey, where'd you get the idea to do that? They go, well, actually, I was on a boat out on a lake and talking with some friends and my family and happened to think of this thing. It just came to mind. I'm like, okay, you can't get any more discovery and out of left field than that. But that's... so that's what we're doing. So that's over my shoulder is the logo for The Checkout. And that's what we do a lot of. And I had to throw it out there because it's discovery is key in everything. And we're going to learn more about that with our guests as well from Pilot. So just throwing that out, just as sort of like a introduction.
To segue nicely, one of my favorite discoveries is discovering either new technologies or new, to me, novel uses of technology. And we'll be talking about some of those things exactly with our guest. So let's bring him in. Sam Matheny. He's the Chief Technology Officer and Executive Vice President at the National Association of Broadcasters. Big titles, and delighted to have him with us. Sam, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech.
Hey, thank you so much. I'm really, really glad to be here with you all and doing one of my favorite things, being able to talk tech. And I was just listening to the story there, and it reminded me of when we said, hey, wouldn't it be neat if we could put our Doppler radar on a telephone? And now that's common practice. But we were some of the first to do that when we were thinking about the way these new data networks and phones and things would work, and the way that broadcasters could leverage that technology to extend their audience.
That you mean by putting Doppler radar on the phone? You mean like as an app, so people can see radar?
Yeah, I mean that's what we did. That's how the conversation started. It was you know, we were looking, and this is back in the 2004 time frame, so no iPhone, no Android, no smartphone didn't exist. Everything flipped open or was a candy bar style phone, and you were first starting to see color screens. And then you were starting to see data networks. And I remember it was a 1X RTT network, and you could get, you know, a blazing, you know, 64 kilobits per second of data across that network. And it was, you know, hey, we could take our TV station and we could put our news on it. We could put our Doppler radar on it. And that was one of our big motivations was, to reach people where they are.
And look at what your idea has become now. You know, and I'm in the middle of that, for that green.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, so looking forward to talking to Sam Matheny for the next hour. He'll be talking, give us a little bit of background on his technical chops from the beginning and some innovative things that he's done. And then the NAB obviously made the right choice in bringing Sam on board to lead, guide, direct, collect, talk to people, and find out how technology is going to carry broadcasters forward. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by one of my favorite technologies, MaxConnect Wireless. It looks like an ordinary cradle point modem, and it is, but what's special are the SIM cards in it. This one has an AT&T and a Verizon SIM card in it, and these SIM cards don't just connect you to the data network. They connect you with the second highest priority possible to the data network of the carrier that you choose, either AT&T or Verizon. The only users that have a higher priority than a Max Connect user is a first responder. So as a broadcaster, this box is amazing. And you may have seen a demo that I did a couple of weeks, 3 weeks ago or so, just before Christmas time, I was using this very modem and passing reliably that 400 kilobit per second. I know it's not much data, but it's got to be reliable. We can't lose a packet. Micro MPX signal coming from my house to a resort here in the Gatlinburg area. And it was flawless. Every packet, far as I know, every packet came through and I was getting good FM signal. I want to tell Chris Tobin about something I found out today from Josh Bone. You know, I noticed that this modem has a WAN connection on it. And I was hoping that I could, if I wanted to, I could hook this up. By the way, I just noticed I got smudge on my knuckles here. If you're watching the show, you'll see that is that came from the fireplace. I was stoking the fire just before the show. Anyway, it's got a WAN connection on here. There it is. And the WAN connection can be, you know, obviously a wired connection coming in maybe to your facility. And what if you don't want to use the MaxConnect wireless all the time, but you want it to jump in when needed? Well, that's what this does. Because it's a router and you can set priorities, if the WAN connection goes away or becomes unstable, you can have the MaxConnect router connect you to a very stable wired wireless connection where your data has priority. You can use this in the middle of a stadium. Everybody else is on their phones doing their Facebook thing and checking scores and even FaceTiming with people, and your data still gets through. So it's great for broadcasters, for remote broadcasts, for backup STL to the transmitter site. It's good for audio, video, whatever IP you need, and it's MaxConnect Wireless. Look at MaxConnectWireless.com. It's spelled funny, so we'll have it in the show notes, and you can get one of these for yourself. Josh Bone tells me that people are using this just all over the place and getting great, great results with it. And the plans vary anywhere from about $50 a month on up to however much data that you want to use. All right. So enough about MaxConnect. Appreciate them very much, and we'll do another show using that modem here in just a week or two. On the show here, Sam Matheny, excuse me, is our guest. And Sam, if you would, give us a little elevator talk about your technical background. We want to know that you're not just a pretty face in a suit when you're talking to us about the technical possibilities of the future.
Well, I don't think I've ever been called a pretty face in a suit, but so I don't think we got to worry about that. But so I'm probably not your traditional technologist and or engineer anyway, in that I'm not a classically trained electrical engineer, but I have always had a mind for technology, and I've really spent most of my time in the data and networking side of things. And so in college, I studied communications at East Carolina University, and I worked at radio and TV stations as well as in the library. With something called the North Carolina Research and Education Network, doing video and data networking. And so I had the classic broadcaster background and orientation, if you will, combined with data networking, which is the route that I really took initially. Was I went out to Research Triangle Park. I worked at a place called MCNC, which was the home of the North Carolina Research and Education Network, as well as the North Carolina Supercomputing Center. So for about 3 years, I got really exposed to a lot of the cutting edge of what was taking place in computers and networking. And then from there, I went back to Capital Broadcasting Company, or I went to Capital Broadcasting Company based in Raleigh, and worked at the nexus of the very early days of the internet. The commercial internet, I should say, and broadcasting. And so literally the CEO, Jim Goodman, he said, I want you to take what we're doing in broadcasting. I want you to put it on the internet, and I want you to figure out how to make a business out of it. And so I was very fortunate to work there in the mid-90s, and then ultimately spent 20 years there, almost 20 years, about 19, moving between the radio division, the television division, the satellite broadcast division, then started a new media division with their current president and chief operating officer, Jimmy Goodman, a fabulous person, and then ultimately ended up working in corporate as vice president of policy and innovation.
I understand you said you were involved early on with the internet, the early commercial internet. And I believe you had some work with what that early website was, broadcaster.com.
That? Well, even earlier than that was Mark Cuban's company was AudioNet. And and we at Capital Broadcasting Company, when they were just streaming audio, we were early supporters and backers of that company from an investment standpoint and then also a content provider standpoint. And then from there, you know, the story's been written. I mean, Mark went on and rebranded the company as broadcast.com, sold it to Yahoo, et cetera, et cetera. And but we were there at the very beginning because just as I was talking about, hey, I want to put my Doppler on that phone, you know, we were sitting around and saying, hey, you know, we want to take our signal and make it available on the internet. And so that was what I was tasked with very early on in my career.
It may be possible that you and Chris Tobin at cross paths or came real close, because you were telling me that early in your streaming career, you were getting the CBS station streaming, and 1010 Winds was a very early station that you helped to get streaming on the web, right?
So, well, in particular on mobile, so maybe not on the web, but on mobile, we when we started the new media division at Capital Broadcasting Company, one of the divisions or companies that we started was one called News Over Wireless. And we developed all of the mobile applications. We started, again, back with the very early phones. So before your smartphones were out there. I know that's hard to imagine.
But no, it is.
We're out there and you were carrying that flip phone or that candy bar style phone. We were working with the carriers directly. So we went out and did business deals with Sprint, with Verizon, with AT&T to do on-deck apps. And these were apps that were typically written in Java code or other programming languages that ran on those specific handsets. And so we developed that, built out that portfolio. When the iPhone came out, we were one of the very first developers to launch broadcast radio and television applications on the iPhone and on Android, and ended up being one of their preferred partners with Apple, and had a lot of fun. Had a lot of fun breaking new ground and finding new ways to distribute broadcast content. We were fortunate enough to have CBS partner with us in those early days, and we ran all of the mobile applications for CBS, Fox, and really hundreds of other stations as well.
You are watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 474. I'm here, Kirk Harnack. Chris Tobin is along, too, coming to us live from Newark, New Jersey. And I want to remind Chris that for the rest of the show, now that we got some background on Sam Matheny from the NAB, we're going to be looking at some thoughts about future technology, all digital radio at ATSC 3.0 for television, and how that may affect content creators, and also artificial intelligence. And I know so little about AI that I'm just dying to know what Sam's thoughts are about those. So, Chris, we got a good show ahead. Our show This Week in Radio Tech brought to you in part by our friends at CalRec. We'll be right back.
CalRec Type R is a modular, expandable IP-based radio system featuring three slimline panels, a fader panel, a large soft panel, and a small soft panel easily configured to give the operator full control. Layouts are saved and recalled quickly between shows. A single 2RU core with integrated I/O gets customers up and running fast, and that single core can power up to three independent mixing environments with no sharing of DSP resources. Available in four DSP packs, and as your station grows, larger packs can be added, enabling it to grow with you. Power to the surface is supplied via standard PoE switches, keeping cabling to a minimum. Type R is fully AES-67 compatible, as defined by SMPTE 2110, which means that it is also compliant with NMOS discovery and connection management specs. All these features combined make Type R the most flexible radio console you can buy. Find out more at calrec.com/twert.
Thanks a lot, CalRec, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Another one of our sponsors is Angry Audio and their Studio Hub cables. You know Studio Hub, these kind of cables right here that make wiring your studio just a breeze, a flash. I almost wired a whole studio without soldering, but stupid me forgot to order the cable I needed, and so I had to wire some RCA connectors onto some audio wires. Oh, what a pain. But I could have bought them from Studio Hub, from Angry Audio. And, you know, they also come in this kind. If you don't like the kind that you've got to plug a cable into with the female RJ45, you can also get them already made up. This is a 6-foot long, pretty standard deal here, 6-foot long cable with male or female XLRs on one end and an RJ45 configured in the Studio Hub standard on the other end. This has been such a great standard. And like the innovation we're going to be talking about on this show, 20 years ago, Studio Hub, the invention of that made such a difference for broadcasters. Here's another example. Here's a little headphone amplifier module from Studio Hub. And yes, you can get this today from Angry Audio. And it's got a couple of RJ45 connectors on it. And they're wired, of course, in the Studio Hub standard to carry left and right analog audio plus power. And you can also loop it through to another headphone jack amplifier and another. You can power several of them right off that. And then the user gets to plug in either quarter inch or eighth inch headphones. And of course, they have a volume control right there. And there's mounting and brackets available for it too. So you see, the Studio Hub stuff is available. If your dealer said, oh no, they've closed their doors. No, wrong. Angry Audio made a deal, got all the Studio Hub stuff, and they're building the cables and adapters again once again. So contact your dealer and go to angryaudio.com, angryaudio.com. Check it out right there. Studio Hub is back. And if you've wired any studios, you know how helpful Studio Hub really is. Thanks for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech, angryaudio.com. All right, Chris Tobin is along, and I'm Kirk Harnack, and Sam Matheny from the NAB is our guest. Sam, I guess we have three topics, and each one of them could take a while to talk about. I guess in no particular order, you mentioned traditional radio broadcasters moving into all digital radio, and that sounds scary. I mean, the hybrid mode of for example, HD radio, it's interesting. 1 AM station's gone all digital on AM with no analog. That's a little scary to me, just because of not being able to hit the people who don't have a digital radio. But maybe you're even speaking of a bigger picture than that. Why don't you kind of give us your thoughts on this all digital stuff?
So, yes, you're exactly right. But I think where I like to start is sort of with our NAB technology mission, which is that we improve lives through broadcast technology and broadcaster innovation. And I think that two of the three things that we're going to talk about today are really in that first part of broadcast technology. I mean, they're talking about the core over the air sort of transmission and broadcasting, whereas as the third in this respect, I'm speaking of AI, is really, you know, a place for broadcaster innovation. It is broadcasters taking new technologies, whether that is the web or whether it's a mobile phone or in this case, artificial intelligence, and going, how can I use this technology to improve my business and my service to the community. So, but as it relates to the all digital process, yes, WWFD was the first station to go all digital. I think that there's really a variety of things that enabled them to be able to make that move. And one was a desire to, you know, put out the best possible audio quality that they could. And so they knew they were going to be able to do that with a digital technology. I think another element that enabled them to do that was the regulatory environment. And what I mean by that is that they had the ability to set up an FM translator. And so they, by putting their signal on FM, they were able to maintain their audience, which gave them some of the flexibility that they needed and wanted to be able to experiment with all digital. Because all digital is much preferable, especially with AM to the hybrid mode. So they are on the air. They're in Frederick, Maryland, and Dave Colasar is the engineer there, and he's done just a fabulous job, as evidenced by recently being named Radio World's Excellence in Engineering Award winner. And they are on the air with an all-digital signal. To do that, they did have to seek a special license, if you will, an experimental license from the FCC to be able to go to all-digital. But they've been very and Dave's been very vocal about this, both at the radio show in Dallas. He did a talk there about the results that they've gotten, about the quality they've gotten, about the phone calls that they've gotten from people who are listening to them in all digital. When with with HD radios, they can pick up that all digital AM signal, and that's true whether that's in your home or in all of the automobiles today that have HD radio.
When I heard that the all digital AM would work on any AM radio that would pick up HD, I was flabbergasted at the prescience of the designers to say, you know, we're going to have these extra modes. Let's go ahead and put the code in there to make that happen. Did that surprise or amaze you, or is it just me?
Well, no, it is. I think it's very smart. I think they realize this is going to be a transition and we have to start seeding the market. And, you know, you start thinking about things about chicken or egg. Am I going to start, you know, broadcasting first, or am I going to get the receivers in the market first? And, you know, I think with the move to digital radio, it was the notion that this is going to be a sustained transition. We're going to get the receivers in the cars. Most folks are going to be listening probably to a digital FM first, but we're going to have that capability for AM as well. And so it's really worked out well for folks to be able to, you know, turn that signal on and have a market of, you know, tens of millions of receivers already out there in cars and homes.
When you started answering my first question on this topic of all digital radio, you actually started answering a question that I guess I hadn't asked, but I'm glad that you answered this way, because you reminded me that all digital radio doesn't necessarily imply all digital over the air RF transmissions in radio. I mean, who knows what radio is going to be looking like in the future? I mean, personally, when I partake of radio these days, it is mostly online. In the car, I'll still occasionally hit the radio, especially in places where I don't have good cellular connectivity. So all the different, if you're a content creator, maybe it doesn't make as big a difference anymore as to how that content reaches the masses. And so I want to make sure I involve Chris Tobin here, because the station that he's engineering at is doing a lot of things online with real quality content. So much, if not all of it, is original stuff. So maybe, Sam, you could address that, and then I'd like to hear Chris's comments afterwards. Sam, you're talking about more than simply the RF delivery method.
Well, I am. What I think of broadcasting, I don't think of broadcasters as solely broadcasters. The truth is that broadcasters today are multi-platform digital media companies, and they are broadcasting in digital using their traditional over-the-air signals to provide greater service, better quality, more diversity of content, they are also leveraging online and cellular opportunities to reach audiences in new ways. And so I'm really talking about all of that as it relates to All Digital FM. That is that core over the air technology improvement, and I think that we're starting to see the results of that thanks to the regulatory environment and leaders like Hubbard Broadcasting, who have stepped up at WWFD to say, all right, we're really going to take this to the next step. What's really heartening about that is the notion that Ben Downs at Bryan Broadcasting has then said, hey, this is great, we want more broadcasters to be able to do this, and we don't want them to have to ask for special permission. We think that they should just be able to do that. And so they filed a petition for rulemaking, hopefully broadcasters who want to do this in the future will be able to just simply do it as a matter of course, as opposed to seeking special permission.
And that's where, since you are at the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, you represent broadcasters' particular interests in this. And it seems sure. Like for some decades, broadcasters they didn't quite have a monopoly, but they were in a pretty good position to disseminate information, whether it's news or music, especially because newspapers can't play music, right? And today with smartphones and the internet, almost anyone can be kind of a broadcaster. But as a broadcaster myself, part owner of 14 radio stations, I know that broadcasters are in a unique position to make and produce quality content. Not that others can't, but broadcasters already have the gear, they have the room, they have the facilities to do that. And sometimes I think they should do a little better job of stepping up, because there's some non-broadcasters making some good content out there. But I can appreciate that your position is you specifically want to help broadcasters in making sure that they are using technologies innovatively and to their fullest extent. Am I kind of right in that regard?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly what we want to do. We want to help them again, have the technology, the best possible standards for their over the air transmission, but also in adopting these new technologies that may be focused on engaging folks in other ways. I mean, you think about the adoption of the smart speaker right now, and the fact that people are talking to Siri, they're talking to Alexa, they're talking to Google. And, when they do that, we want them to be talking about broadcasting and asking to consume that content. And so, and that's why I think radio is one of the most popular uses on smart speaker systems. It's because there is that production quality there. There is that expertise there. And, as those competitive barriers to entries or new players are reduced, a la the internet, then it is that quality that's going to stand out and drop.
I wonder if Chris Tobin could comment for a sec here on how his station or other stations he's working with are benefiting from non-traditional analog broadcasting and other methods of distribution, and maybe how can the NAB make that any easier for you guys when it comes to your transmitters and FCC rules and lobbying on your behalf, Chris?
We've been enjoying great benefit from the non-traditional, if you will, with our videos that we're producing. We have artist interviews. It's a two-step, well, not two steps. It's, I like to call the internet or the multimedia portion of our operation a augmentation to what we do as broadcasters. As a content creator, as people who tell stories, that we've been doing it since the first broadcast in KDKA and before that. It's about the story. It's about telling a story. And if you can't tell it properly, it doesn't matter how well the technology is. So we have taken the approach of, hey, we've been doing it on the radio. We do it well. And now it's time to put pictures to the audio. so that you do have a horizontal control in the car if you want, but on the newer cars. And we've found that it's working. It works very well. Just before the holidays start, we had a couple of artists come through and got a chance to talk with them about what they thought about video, YouTube, and Vimeo, and all the other video platforms that are out there. And this one artist I was talking to, and he was 22 years old. He's an accomplished pianist and plays at Lincoln Center and Carnegie Hall and other places. So it's not like he's just out of school. And he was telling me how he's been watching our videos for the last 8 years now and enjoys them because it helps them to look at it in a different way. Same interview you hear on the radio, no different there. But the difference is the music portion where they perform. On the radio, you sort of create your own picture. With the video, you see it. Now you put it together, go, oh. And it creates even more of an interest and a following for those who look at it. And I think broadcasters need to start rethinking how they tell the story. I know over the holiday weekend, I had met up with some friends. We haven't seen each other for a while, and we got talking about where radio is going and what's going on, how some stations we know have been sold, have been bought, they're failing, or the classic line is, we can't afford to do this, or, well, we have to save money in order to make money. It's like, no, you got it all wrong. If you're a local station, and every radio station is local, look at your local backyard. Do not look at national sales as your only source of income. That should be augmenting. Look at local, look at what you can contribute, and that's where you'll win. And the local could be something as simple as, oh, wow, look at this. We have a group of schools that do have music departments that we could be talking with them if we're a music station, working with them, educating, be a curators, if you will. Or maybe it's a sports program you have, a station, and you have high school sports or even grammar school sports. You'd be surprised how quickly you can suddenly become the cat's meow in the community. The community could be of a 5 million person population or 4,000. It doesn't matter. And then you build from that the ecosystem of the revenue building. And before you know it, you now have some what I like to call buying power. And now you can look at the new technologies that Sam's talking about. And NAB Pilot says, hey, here's what's going on. Broadcasters consider it. And you could be a station that says, well, we're going to do all digital because now we have this and that, and we have the buying power to be able to make this happen. And we understand why, and we see the return. But if you don't do that, if you don't look at the bigger picture, the high elevation, you'll never get to the point of, wow, we're self-sustaining. So that's what we've been doing here with our music. It's a jazz format. And everybody, as soon as you say, oh, jazz music, there's already a 50% of the mindset is, oh, it's this. And the reality is it's not. So what we do now is audio and video together, and you can see the difference and go, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. And we do live broadcasts from the local clubs around New York City and jazz festivals around the country. Like I said, we did some stuff in South Africa, and we did in Europe and France, in Paris, and back in November at the concert, jazz festival, Montreal Jazz Festival we do also. That's been going on for some 4 years. So these are the things that local stations should do and look at for their particular genre. So you're a pop station, there's plenty of places you could be at a venue. In New York City alone, we have several pop stations that do very well with very many venues and have been doing it for many years and are very successful. So that's what I think needs to be looked at. All the multimedia platforming, whatever you want to call it, we're a radio station. Broadcasting, remember, comes from agriculture. It was a piece of farm equipment. It sowed the seeds in the ground. That's what it did. It spread them out onto the field. Broadcasting is the same way. It's AM, FM, TV, digital, internet, whatever you want to call it. You're just reaching out and trying to, sow your seeds. Think in those terms, and you'd be surprised how all of a sudden you can find new sources of NTR, non-traditional revenue, and build up that buying power that you need and stop saying, well, we have to save in order to make, or we can't do this, we can't afford it. Because I can't tell you how many times I talk with people, and it's all I hear is what they can't do. But I've worked with programmers who all they believe is it can be done. And boy, let me tell you, we've had a few flops, but we've had some great successes. And that's how you have to look at it.
I love the fact that broadcasters think this way, forward-thinking ones do. Hey, it's This Week in Radio Tech, episode 474 with Kirk Harnack, Chris Tobin, and our guest is Sam Matheny. He's the CTO and EVP at the NAB. We're going to be talking more with Sam. We got a couple of more incredible topics coming up. ATSC 3.0 and how that might impact non-television broadcasters. It'd be interesting, the partnerships that may come about from that. Or maybe I'm all wrong. And artificial intelligence. What does that mean for consumers of broadcasting and for content creators. That's coming up. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by Broadcasters General Store at bgs.cc on the web. And at BGS, they are the purveyors of some fantastic gear, like from Henry Engineering and the Henry Engineering Sportscaster. This is the sports broadcast audio control system, the Henry Sportscaster. It's an audio control system for managing the audio portion of a sporting event or like radio or a video broadcast. It's a great audio portion for your video. When used with the Henry Engineering Sports Pods, the Sportscaster creates an integrated system that includes all essential audio functions, including audio mixing for air or webcast, headphone audio management and distribution, and off-air intercom. The Sportscaster is a one-box solution that's comprehensive, and yet it's intuitive and easy to use. They integrate all the functions in one device, so one person can sit at this box and control it, control the on-air mix, control the headphone feeds, and also the sports pods can help you control those too. And you get intercom. So that, let's say you go do a high school basketball game or football game. You want to do it on the radio? Great. The Sportscaster can help do that for you. It's really an all-in-one device. But if you're doing it for video, as so many radio stations are doing now, putting on their local cable system or streaming it on Facebook, or they're on the website, or even live on YouTube, for example, or Twitch.tv, the Sportscaster from Henry can absolutely get this done for you. Get that audio perfect. Intercom is so important to a broadcast. You know, most of us radio broadcasters haven't used intercom, but when you're producing something like this, man, is it good to have. You can get the next shot ready. You can speak a word into the ear of the color guy, the on-air guy, the play-by-play person, the field reporter. You can cue the field reporter and say, hey, we're about to go to you. Let's look at that injured player, or let's see what the coach thinks about being ahead by 24 points. All that is possible, not only possible, but easy, with the Henry Sportscaster. It's a 1RU box, and it's just we had Hank Landsberg on a show previously talking about this, and it's just amazing what this box will do. And where do you get it? Well, you go to Broadcasters General Store. That's bgs.cc. BGS.cc. I've got their number memorized. I have for years, 352-622-7700. Talk to anybody that answers the phone there, and you're going to have a good experience. Tell them to put an extra sharp pencil to it as well. They always do anyway at Broadcasters General Stores. Thanks a lot to BGS at BGS.cc and to Hank Landsberg at Henry Engineering. Appreciate you guys and the great equipment that Henry Engineering makes. All right, we're talking with Sam Feeney at the NAB about the future of broadcasting technology. Sam, would you like to cover this ATSC thing a bit? We as radio guys don't know much about it, and I'm not sure a lot of TV guys know a lot about it either. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I do, but I can't help but reflect on what Chris was just talking about broadcasting originating from agriculture, because my first job in radio was at WETC, 5:40 a.m. first on your dial, and I was there, and WETC was in North Carolina. I grew up in a little town called Zebulon, and WETC was sort of in between Nightdale Window and Zebulon, and WETC stood for We Entertain Tobacco Country. So the station was, got its roots in agriculture, excuse me, if you will. And so, when I think about, spreading seeds and doing the work, as we were talking about all digital AM, reflecting back on that. And I just got to take a moment and say David Lair with NAB is a great engineer here who really did a lot of the early work with all digital AM field testing as well as lab testing. And that has gotten us to where we are today. But as it relates to ATSC, in particular ATSC 3.0, or next gen TV, as we're beginning to refer to it now, it also had a lot of groundwork done. It started, about 9-10 years ago. The ATSC, which stands for Advanced Television Systems Committee, and the ATSC is actually an international standards development organization. I used to serve on the board of the ATSC as well as a number of their committees. But they develop the standards. People assume when you turn on your TV that it just works. And, you know, it's like, how does it happen? And it's still kind of magical to me. But you know, it works because there's an organization like the ATSC that has members from the broadcast side, from the receive side, from universities and research institutions, as well as professional equipment manufacturers that come together and they actually put it all down on paper and they write a standard that says, this is how we are going to transmit. And then receiver manufacturers can then go build receivers based to that transmission standard. And so that is what the ATSC is. We did our first transition from analog to digital back in, you know, about 10 years. We're celebrating June, I think it was, of 2019, we celebrated the shutoff of analog television. So back in 2009 was the official transition, and that was from analog broadcasting to ATSC 1, what is referred to as ATSC 1 or 1.0, and it was the first digital standard that the United States adopted. Subsequently, Mexico, Canada, South Korea, and others have also broadcasting in that standard. So it is truly an international broadcast standard. What makes this new standard or 3.0 unique is that it is the world's first broadcast standard that is based on IP or internet protocol as the transport layer. ATSC 1 is based on MPEG as a transport layer. And you know, you could scratch your head and go, well, what does that mean? Who cares? You know, but foundationally, it is using the same transport mechanism that is used on the wired internet today, what your laptops are using, what your other devices, computers, et cetera, are using. And so by having that same technology, it basically takes over-the-air television broadcasting and it makes it a giant wireless IP network. And so that opens up lots of opportunities for integration into new devices, as well as even wholly new applications for what can be delivered via broadcasting, because now it's, again, really a wireless IP network. Most people may or may not know that on the traditional internet, about 80% of the traffic that is on the internet today is video. And so, yeah. You know, if broadcasters can, you know, reach that same sort of ratio in what they deliver over their wireless, you know, over the air transmission, there's, you know, a nice chunk of bandwidth is going to be used for some new business that is yet to be developed or determined. So that's really what's exciting to me about ATSC3. When I try to put it in terms that people, you know, can really relate to, they, you say, all right, you're going to get a better picture because you can go to ultra HD versus an HD signal. You can go to 4K. You can go to high dynamic range and wide color gamut and higher bit depths and all sorts of, you know, technical things that are going to basically give you a much better picture. But you can also get much better audio. You can go from a 5.1, which surround, which is supported today with ATSC 1, to really immersive audio systems or 3D object-oriented audio, which is going to open up all sorts of opportunities for traditional, you know, better picture, better sound, more immersive experiences, better storytelling is what that ultimately enables, whether that story is the news or whether that story is a drama or whether that story is the, you know, your favorite sports team that you want to watch during the week.
One of the complaints that I recall hearing about ATSC 1 was its propensity to not work well in a mobile situation. And there are other standards around the world that work better for mobile television. I'm not thinking just of television. ATSC 3, I understand, you correct me if I'm wrong, is designed to work well in mobile situations, whether it's a car or perhaps handheld devices. Is it possible that through partnerships we might see a television licensee transmit, you know, some high quality programming, some standard def programming, and maybe a whole suite or bouquet of audio programming, maybe along with pictures or metadata like that, that people would end up perhaps migrating some of their listening habits to actually listening to radio on TV channels. Do you see, you foresee that?
So the way I think about ATSC3 is, again, it's a wireless IP pipe. And so it's delivering data. It's delivering bits. Those bits can be video. They can be audio. They could be Excel spreadsheets for that matter. I mean, it can deliver all sorts of wireless data. And so I think that there are going to be lots of programming opportunities where people are trying to figure out what the right mix is. I think the other notion is that because it is IP-based, it is designed to work both over the air, but also hand-in-hand with a wired connection. So you can deliver some content over the air and other content via your internet connection, and then they get combined at the receiver. And so it really means that there can be all sorts of different compelling content mixes of various different types of content. And
oh my god!
And the other thing that I will mention, because you did talk about mobile, is ATSC1 was designed with a single operating point in mind. And it was going to be 19.4 megabits per second of throughput, really 19.39 and a really long number, but 19.4 megabits per second of throughput at a single operating point that was determined by putting a antenna on a roof. ATSC1 follows, Shannon's curve, which we won't get into all of that, but it just means that you have various different operating points, and you can choose as a broadcaster to optimize your signal to either have greater data throughput, but it might be a little bit more difficult to receive, or you can design it to be really easy to receive and maybe have less data throughput, or even better yet, you can do both at the same time. Because it is very, very configurable, has multiple operating points, and that becomes very flexible, especially when you think about combining that with a wired connection to create different services. So super excited about that. The one other thing that I will mention as it relates to mobility is the notion of a single frequency network. And a broadcaster using ATSC3 would have the ability to deploy a single frequency network. And, typically television broadcasting has been, a one tall tower at very high power. And that's how the signal gets distributed. With a single frequency network, you could actually put in multiple lower power transmitters and they would all use the same frequency. And you basically raise your signal floor and you're able to really provide deep indoor reception and or mobile reception.
I wish we were not running out of time, but we are. So I want to move to AI. And I was thinking of how ATSC3 and AI could work together. And I'm formulating a couple ideas here. Again, as an audio guy, maybe that a main program could come over the air through an ATSC data stream. And then my customized content, my device, my phone, my radio, my car radio would reach out and grab the other content that isn't on this mainstream, and do that based upon some AI decisions, as to what I like to hear. So I don't hear an ad for the 15th time about a cruise I'm not interested in, but I will hear about things that based upon my search results or things like that I am interested in. Okay, enough about that. Sam, artificial intelligence, this is a field that's interesting to you and exciting, but I have absolutely no idea for sure how it applies to broadcasting. You want to inform us?
Well, so, artificial intelligence or AI is something that we are very interested in at Pilot. And Pilot, by the way, is one of our innovation initiatives at NAB. It used to be called NAB Labs, but we rebranded it to Pilot a few years ago. And it's really where we try and do some of this further looking research and development. And so that's what we're focused on. Through our Pilot initiative this year, we have a program we call the Innovation Challenge. And the challenge prompt this year was around artificial intelligence. And what we challenged people to do was to build an AI character that can have conversations with individual viewers, listeners, or consumers. This AI, conversational AI character, trainable by the broadcasters, and the broadcaster should be able to, you know, impart, if you will, their own personality to it. And so that is one example. Conversational AI is one example. And by that, I don't just mean, hey, Siri, or hey, Google, or Alexa. It extends to things like chatbots. You may not know there are billions of messages being sent every day via numerous types of messaging platforms where people are actually chatting with a chatbot. It is not a real person. It is an AI character that is trained to interact based on certain questions. But as it relates to, so that would be an application. There's other applications in broadcasting where, or in data and media, where using structured data, you can have artificial intelligence write a script for you. And so that particularly works well with things like financial reporting or baseball box scores. Well-structured data, and an AI client can go in and write the script directly from the box score and tell you what happened because of the way the data is structured and the capabilities of the AI. Other applications that our broadcasters need to be thinking about that maybe aren't as productive or user-friendly are things like deepfakes and the ability to create synthetic content where it is not really the President of the United States speaking to you. It is somebody using artificial intelligence to make a deep fake, to make the president say something that he would never say. And so, we're looking at things like that. I mean, there's Project Voco, which is being done by Adobe, which is being called Photoshop for speech. There's a company called Lyrebird that says it can take 1 minute of audio and create a perfect synthesized voice. There's something called WaveNet, which was created by Google's DeepMind that is along those same lines where, you know, they're creating synthetic content through applications in artificial intelligence. And that can be used for good. Or it can be used for bad. And so the key thing is for broadcasters to be aware of it and try to find places where they can use these types of artificial intelligence to build stronger relationships with their communities, as well as to be aware of, you know, other people who may have other ideas or applications for AI so that, you know, we can either compete against it or keep a watchful eye on it to make sure that we don't perpetuate it.
You mentioned three technologies or software packages in your talk just then. I've made a note of all of them for our viewers and listeners. The links to these will each be in the show notes, so we'll have that coming up for you. And I want to point out something. Some years ago, I think many of us have run across chatbots at various support websites or things like that. And we could tell that this is not, you know, it's not a person. Or we've received phone calls that you can tell this is, it's good, but it's not perfect. And Sam, I think you're talking about stuff that's so good that we can't tell. Isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the real concern, that it is a deep fake, meaning it is really done well, and that you can't tell the difference between what is real and what is fake. And there are also things called cheap fakes, which are the greatest example of a cheap fake, I think, right now is where political operatives with a particular point of view decided to take Nancy Pelosi and slow her speech down to make it appear as if she was drunk. And so it doesn't have to be a super sophisticated deep fake. It can be the combination of a deep fake with a cheap fake, and it just helps sow distrust in information. And broadcasters are the number one most trusted source for information in the United States, and to particularly local broadcasters. And so, you know, to have that position of trust and honor in your community, you need to be aware of these types of technologies. And again, have ways to apply them. I mean, another good way that it can be applied, and this is a project that we did through Pilot. We have pilot members, and some of our pilot members are companies like IBM, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and others that are Avis Budget's another one, where we're focused on, you know, where is the intersection between broadcasting and these new technologies, and how can we apply them? So with IBM a couple of years ago, again, you could see this at Futures Park at NAB Show, but with IBM, we created a system where they applied AI to a newsroom system to help identify video clips. And it says, oh, you're looking at a clip of Michael Jordan. You know, here are all the other clips of Michael Jordan that I have that may be relevant to what you're doing. And you can make that consumer facing and put it, you know, on the website where it automatically presents that content to the end user, or you can make it part of your production process where, you know, not only does it say it's Michael Jordan, but it says it's also got Dean Smith in the background. And so let me, you know, look for other clips that have Dean Smith in it. And then as a producer or a line producer, all of a sudden, you know, what would have been hours of research of where is that clip? I know I have it somewhere. All of a sudden gets presented to you. More recently, we've been looking at whether artificial intelligence can be used to automate closed captioning, as an example. If you could automate live closed captioning, it has to be better than humans can do to be useful. So one, you're going to get that benefit. Two, you would assume you would save money. So it's going to be more accurate. You're going to save money. And then three, you're going to be able to create derivative works. So all of a sudden you've got this closed captioning. Well, guess what? Now your content becomes much more searchable. Now your content becomes much more discoverable and more people will consume it. That has a benefit. Additionally, you could then look at creating a derivative work, which, all right, I'm going to automatically translate it. And now my closed captionings are available in whatever language you want. And so there's lots of different things that are possible out there. And that's really the type of stuff that we are exploring through Pilot and that we're really excited about as it relates to some of the applications of artificial intelligence as it relates to broadcasting.
Exciting. And what you just, the last thing you talked about there is the transcription. And I know that a partner that is a partner with my employer at the TELUS Alliance, a partner by the name of Broadcast Bionics in the UK, they are using offsite quick transcription and marrying that with recording of video cameras in a radio studio and, of course, the audio. And with, I'm sure they're not the first to do it, but they have a video audio editor where you simply highlight the words that you want in a clip. And instead of looking at squiggly lines, you're looking at the actual transcribed words. And of course, they relate to the millisecond to the audio that was said in the video. And you can edit audio that way and make a quick edit to go on Facebook or YouTube or other social media. So that's very exciting. And then, but then adding the AI to have things like that automatically identified. And find similar clips. That's exciting. Hey, we're just about to wrap up the show, and I didn't warn Sam about this. So, Sam, I'm gonna talk for a minute, and Chris is gonna talk too, and we're gonna put on your thinking cap. We like a tip of the week. So, if you have a book, maybe something that you've written, an article, or some other resource that you'd like to point our listeners and viewers to, we'd like to give you a chance to relate that to us after the next spot break. We call it our tip of the week and just something that people can walk away with and study a bit more. So if you could find a study resource, that'd be great. This Week in Radio Tech, our 474th episode is brought to you in part by Angry Audio. I know we talked about them already, but they also make a whole line of electronic products. They're still have in stock and remaking some of the Studio Hub lines. So I showed you earlier this headphone app. They have these in the Decora space, so you can easily integrate that in your studio. They also have this beautiful bracket that can go underneath a table. Curved here, so you don't hurt your knees on that if it's under the table, and it really protects very well the headphone amp. But if you want a newer design headphone amp, well, they have this one. This is called the Guest Gizmo from Angry Audio. On the back, it's got inputs for left and right audio, and it's got an insert point, and it also has a logic port here too that's smart enough to figure out if this button on the front needs to be an on-off button or if it needs to be a cough button. There's some smart electronics in here. And there is a headphone amp in here. The thing that I really like about this Guest Gizmo from Angry Audio is that you can install it beautifully into your cabinet, into your console, into your tabletop by drilling a round hole. A round 2 3/4 inch hole saw. This will fit right in, and the lip of the cover here will make it look really pretty. It looked like you were an expert at doing that. I can't hold that straight. There we go. The Guest Gizmo from Angry Audio. Check it out and all the other cool devices like their new Bluetooth adapter and other things at angryaudio.com. Thanks a lot. Thanks. I want to really want to thank Mike Dosh for putting together Angry Audio and getting some of the things that broadcasters need intelligently gathered together in one place, angryaudio.com. All right. I'm Kirk Harnack along with Chris Tobin and Sam Matheny with the NAB, our guest. Chris is always ready with a tip of the week. By the way, my quick tip, and we tell our guests this, and thank goodness Sam, you know, already had his computer set up. But here at the at Blessings Cabin, the Eastern Outpost of This Week in Radio Tech, I was on Wi-Fi during my test with Sam earlier today, and it was okay, but there were a few times when it wasn't okay. So before the show, I got wired up, and you know what? I think it's been just about perfect here. My connection with you guys has certainly been good. And so that just reminds me to tell you, if you've got an IP connection that really needs to work, wired is always better. You're not contending with other RF interferences or other devices that you may or may not even know about. Get wired. And I got wired here in our cabin. I had to find a really long cable and run around the door and down the hallway to the router. But wired is always better. So remember that, engineers, when you're doing remote broadcasts, if you got to use Wi-Fi, okay. There's times that Chris Tobin has used some point-to-point Wi-Fi with Ubiquiti products, and that's fine. But he's been under good control of it. But I thought I had things under control here at the cabin. Not so much. Do the wired thing when you can. Chris Tobin, got a tip of the week for us?
Yeah. I have a tip of the week. But before I forget, when we're talking about ATSC 3.0, for friends, I've been explaining to them how this works. I was doing a lot of stuff at World Trade Center over the last couple of years. Think of this. ATSC 3.0 is a multicast network. It's a multi-tiered signal that goes out over a carrier, and the receiver on the IP side can get whatever you want. That's all I'm going to say. If you're a co-located radio and TV facility, radio programmers, start talking to your TV brethren. There's opportunity there. Just saying. That's all I'm going to call it, because it's power-based, non-orthogonal multiplexing, otherwise known as PNOM, or the multiple access PNOM. So that term right there should tell you exactly what's different about 3.0 compared to 1.0 8VSB. So that's just my homework. I've been researching and trying to figure out how we could figure out doing something with our place, but right now, we're not fortunate enough to have a sister TV station. So, tip of the week. You know, it's funny how things happen. This holiday season, I got called on to do some work on a friend of mine's home studio, which is always a fun thing. And, you know, it's a studio, home studio. He's a morning show host. He's heard on over 168 owned and operated stations across coast to coast. And the network he's on reaches over 220 million people. And I had to help him fix some problems. And he uses Studio Hub a lot, and we were doing some rewiring, and I discovered that all the cat cables underneath the furniture, which is the studio furniture, no numbers. And I was unplugging things and trying to figure out what's up, and it was just a mess. The wheat net he has in the studio stopped working, things didn't talk. I'm like, this doesn't make sense. These cables trace back. It was a mess. So, tip of the week, we'll go back to this again. Here we go. Let's see if we get this right. You see that little guy? It's got a clip holder, so you can stick this on the tool belt or in your box. You can't lose it. Number the cables. Okay, so here's what I'm going to tell you, because I'm rewiring his studio with Studio Hub, and he'll be contacting Angry Audio shortly about that, the parts I recommend. But here's how it's going to work. You take the Studio Hub dongle, doesn't matter, it doesn't need a number, but the Cat 5 cable you're connecting to, That's where the number appears on both ends. So guess what? When you're down deep inside the furniture and you're trying to figure out what the hell's on this switch, you go, okay, I'm on cable number 42. You just holler out. He looks at the other end. Oh, that's the DTV audio out. Perfect. Done. Problem solved. Less than 30 seconds, you know what you're doing. Right now, when I'm up there working on it, I have no idea what things are. We made a mess of stuff, but I got it back up and running. He's on the air this week. He's good. So that's my tip. Label, please do the numbering. I've been in places in the last 2 months where the Cat 5 cables are a mess. I get why. But if you had numbers on them, I wouldn't care. But they don't even number them in a mission critical stuff.
So and you know, in the past, we've sometimes talked about Brady wire labelers, and they're kind of expensive. And you know what? What you just showed us there, I was using those literally 35 years ago because they were available then too. And you don't have to have an expensive wire label. You can use what you got right. Do you have a name for that?
Yeah, it's called the Scotch Code, 3M Scotch Code, STD-0-9 wire marker, tape dispenser, and you can get refills, so it's universal. And the best part is, you know, a lot of people, well, I got to get heat shrink tubing, I got to heat shrink the numbers. Tell you what you do. You get the thick Gorilla tape, the packing tape, the thick stuff, you cut it nice and small, you wrap it around the number, you're done, okay?
Done.
So that's for the broadcasters who complain about they don't make money, so we can't afford to do anything right. For those who do it right, I don't even have to question that. They know what they're doing. Just saying.
All right. I'm eager to hear what Sam Matheny has to give us for a tip of the week. Sam?
All right. I'm going to give you two. But the one that you probably have not heard of, or this would be a great opportunity, is the broadcast blog. And I really think that if you want to stay up to date on what's happening in technology, and in particular broadcast technology, you should visit the broadcast blog. It is written by and curated by the technology team here at NAB. We have not only authors from around the NAB technology department writing on everything from ATSC3 to digital radio to what's happening in streaming to artificial intelligence. We also have guest bloggers from various different universities or other broadcast organizations that join us and contribute as well. And that is available via the NAB Pilot website. So it's not the main NAB.org site, but it's NABpilot.org. And so if you will go to NABpilot.org, you can read the broadcast blog as well as access lots of other information about what we're doing with our pilot program and our pilot members. And then, of course, I have to talk about NAB Show. So NAB Show this year is still going to be in Las Vegas, but it is also going to be shifted a little bit, and it will actually open on Sunday and then close on Wednesday. So the timing of the NAB Show has shifted. We hope to see everyone there. You can learn more about that, of course, at nabshow.com and visit our Futures Park, our Broadcast Engineering and Information Technology Conference, as well as our Digital Futures Conference and so much more. So those are my two tips, nabpilot.org as well as NAB Show.
I will have links to both of those right to the blog at the NAB Pilot website in the show notes. So, Sam, terrific information. And thanks for the reminder about the NAB Show in Las Vegas starting a day earlier than we've all been used to, starting on Sunday and going through Wednesday. Does that leave more time for partying? Is that the reason?
Well, yeah, you know, I'll be working. That's what I'll say.
Okay. Yeah, honey, I'll still be home on Friday. So, all right. Hey, we got to go. This has been a great show. Chris Tobin, thank you for being with us and joining us from WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Appreciate your insights. Sam Matheny, thank you so much for being here as well. We really appreciate you. And we're going to have David Layer. I know we've tried to get together. I haven't tried as hard as I can. He was going to make a great guest. Chris and I did have him on briefly during that antenna celebration, the antenna on the Empire State Building. Remember that going on a couple of years back?
Oh, yeah.
We were on a rooftop, and we had David Layer join us for a few minutes there, but we need to have him on for the whole show.
So, he's great.
All right.
I look forward to it.
We got to go. Thanks to Suncast, our producer, for producing this week in Radio Tech, and Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, where you'll find lots of other fine podcasts, including What the Tech, a podcast about Windows and musings and ruminations about Windows and Microsoft technology. Lots of other ones, too. If you're into comics or wrestling, whatever, you'll find it at GFQ. So we encourage you to watch there. Thanks to our sponsors. Please visit them and let them know you heard about them here on This Week in Radio Tech. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.